The Guardian.
Euro 2012 Football Daily with James Richardson from The Guardian.
Euro 2012, England comes fifth. Pod looks back on the historic and entirely unprecedented quarterfinal exit on penalties against Italy, waves goodbye to the 11 Bulldogs who spent the match camped in their box like something out of the homeless World Cup. Plus, we salute Italy, his snake-like majesty Andrea Pirlo, not past it, just passing it all night long. Ahead of them now, a semi-final with Germany, while Spain take on Portugal. And what of Spain? We put to Sid Lowe the big question, are Spain a bit tedious? We'll never guess what he says in today's Euro 2012 Football Daily. Woo! It's Simon Burnton on Euro 2012 Football Daily. Welcome along, Simon.
Hello, it's
on
a
this
great
hot
pleasure.
Ukraine afternoon.
Yes.
Whoa. I tell you, it's sweltering here. Here's HK1234. He says, are the podcasters in either Ukraine or Poland, or are they just in the normal studio with some sound effects?
That is.
That's bad. Let's ask this man over here. Sir, are we here or not?
Пробачте, ви розмовляєте англійською?
And where's the nearest donut shop?
Я трохи розмовляю українською.
Well, there you go, Jacob Steinberg.
Hello, James.
Hi. Hey. Who'd have thought, eh?
Again.
Again. And here also again, is Paul McInnes once more.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah. It was tight, though, wasn't it? How about England-Italy? Jacob Steinberg, you did minute by minute.
I did.
Anything good about the England performance? Bear in mind, there's some sensitive listeners out there.
Yeah. It was very brave and passionate.
Was it? Was it brave?
Well, it depends on how you would define bravery in a football match, whether it's flinging yourself in front of the ball over and over again and defending heroically, or whether it's taking risks in possession and trying, you know, difficult skills and moves which are beyond England as a football team and as a nation.
There were 15 glorious minutes at the beginning where England seemed to be playing very well. Italy appeared to be on the racks. Mark Lawrenson on the BBC commentary was saying now would be a good time to score.
Right up to the Glenn Johnson chance, no?
Well, Glenn Johnson's chance was at the beginning of that. That was about 4 minutes in, and that period lasted about a quarter of an hour. The fact that first 15 minutes existed only went to make the remainder of the match more tragic. Yeah.
So what do you think happened? Italy?
Well, I guess so. I guess that the Italian midfield started to get more time on the ball, and England didn't have any comeback.
They did change the way they started playing England, and that they stopped closing down Pirlo, for example, and they stopped being confident on the ball, which is what they had been in the first 15 minutes, 20 minutes. They were taking risks, playing like a top European club side amalgamation of players should be able to do. I just have to think it's psychological. My rationale.
But hang on, they were 11 Bulldogs. There's no question about the spirit.
But this is the thing, and I'm sure I saw Joe Hart do a roar before one of the penalties that sent him the wrong way. But it does seem to be this massive dichotomy between this false, we're so pumped up, we're so let's go for it, lad, and then what you see on the pitch, which is kind of not just an absence of belief.
Well,
it's this teetering between.
They tire themselves out, don't they? It's like a.
But not after 20 minutes. Well, I mean,
but the more you give the ball away, the more wearied you get.
But they kept the ball really well for 20 minutes, and then after that, it was like they didn't score, and then they thought, Italy are probably going to come back into this now, and so let's retreat back to 20 yards away from our goal.
I find it really strange, because we saw this a little bit with the Spanish game, that the Spanish left the Italians with plenty of time on the ball, and the Italians were able to relax and play up to their abilities. If Italian players are pressed, they really do panic quickly. I mean, we saw this against Ireland. I was amazed the amount of time Pirlo had for the whole game. Yeah. At no stage did there seem to be the message, close him down. Everybody's known about Pirlo for over a decade now.
I think as we've seen that in the Champions League, when Italian sides have struggled against English sides, they don't. You know, when Arsenal played Milan in the second leg, the pace that Walcott and Oxlade-Chamberlain attacked with Milan, they couldn't handle that. But Spurs, it happened as well last 2 years ago when they pressed Milan high. That's maybe one of the reasons why they got rid of Pirlo. Milan, I thought he couldn't handle that, but Gerrard and Parker got nowhere near him at all, and I think that showed up the limitations of the 4-4-2, these two banks of four that were meant to be very hard to break down, but for a team that weren't really playing with any width, it was very easy for them to find space with when they had more men in the middle.
Well, in one sense, they were hard to break down because Italy couldn't score for 120 minutes, but my word, they had plenty of chances. It's not nice or clever at this point to start pointing the finger and blaming people, so let's do that now. Who really stunk the place out for you most? Who was the biggest disappointment?
I think the biggest disappointment for England throughout the tournament was Ashley Young, yes. Who came into it having played pretty well in the two warm-up games. He scored a goal, set up the goal, they you know, both goals that won them the games against Belgium and Norway. And the problem I always find with Ashley Young, I think that Manchester United fans have found with him, is that he's a bit of a coward, that he hides in the big games, and that's what happened with him with England. He did absolutely nothing throughout, and I'm surprised he didn't get taken off, because I thought Milner was having maybe one of his better games, but the other one was Rooney, who again was dreadful in a knockout game for England.
Again, it was the thing, the kind of odd decision making that went on, particularly from Rooney. Rooney was obviously wanting to take the ball and make things happen, but Young was trying to do the same thing, and he constantly made the wrong decisions, particularly going inside into a nest of Italian midfielders rather than trying to take it out down the line. I don't think we ever saw him beat a fullback in the entirety of the tournament.
It was kind of hard watching the match on television to understand how Stephen Gerrard was so silenced this evening. He had next to no influence on the game outside a few set-piece deliveries. If you look at the number of passes he received over the game...
status, Simon.
OK, according to UEFA stats, he received 28 passes. And this is for England's best player over the course of the tournament. Meanwhile, Glenn Johnson received the same, Ashley Cole more, Wayne Rooney more, Julian Lescott less.
Whereas he should have been the fulcrum of everything.
Well bet the same in 60 minutes.
Right.
Scott Parker, one less. Andy Carroll, many more. So how is it that England got the ball to their best player so infrequently?
Yeah. What about your great Milner stat?
Yeah, well, I've totted up the passes made by Milner over the course of the championship. And the kind of odd thing with that, he played four matches, and in two of those he was reasonably influential. He played around 30 passes. And in the second two, he played around a dozen passes. A massive kind of fall-off in influence. But if you add up every pass attempted, according to Optostats, which I have to say differ wildly from UEFA ones, according to Optostats, James Milner attempted 90 passes over the four matches he played in the tournament, of which 74 were successful. And according to Opta as well, Pirlo attempted 89 passes this evening alone in one match, and 74 of those were successful.
I mean, I think that's partly down to the way England play. It's not just because we are we can't keep possession, although we quite often can't keep possession. It's because we play more direct. We try and take more risks. We try and play the ball quickly, get round the back and score when there's space. So I think that statistical thing doesn't show
although
everything.
None of that happened tonight, did it?
Well, it did in the first 15, 20 minutes, and in the first 5 minutes of the second half. What really pained me was it seemed to, I think the stat I saw was the most common pass combination was between Hart and Andy Carroll.
That's true.
And what I thought about that just said everything about our game plan, and I can't understand it.
And he only came on when? Midway through the second half?
Exactly. But Hart was doing it all game. He was doing it to Welbeck as well. I only saw Hart throw out the ball once. From having possession, and he had the ball loads of times. Yeah. We were always playing it back. I mean, our fullbacks were playing quite high, so it was difficult to find them. But he just never took the opportunity to build from the back. And so often that ball, even if Carroll was winning the first header, came back to us. And I thought that was just why was that? That must have been an instruction. And why did we make that instruction? That really peeved me right off.
I don't know. It's not a barrel of laughs so far, though, is it? You know, what with England going out. Let's dial up Paolo Bandini, who's celebrating with the crazy Italian fans down at some top Italian eatery, and see what they made of the game.
Hi, James. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. I'm afraid Ben wanted atmospheric.
Yeah. Where's the atmosphere?
Yeah. I'm afraid that this being now a significant time after full time, and this being a Sunday night, the atmosphere has dissipated.
Oh, Paolo.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
All right.
I can run around myself and sing Seven Nation Army tunes if that helps, because that's basically what was.
It's tempting, but we're very, very strict on using kind of in any way inauthentic sounds on this show. So tell us what you thought of Italy's performance, eh?
I thought it was great. I thought, you know, you couldn't have asked for much more beyond scoring a goal.
Scoring goals, that's the thing.
You know, that's a fairly significant part, you know, it must be said, it's a fairly significant part of the game. But I think that, you know, there was a discussion between me and a couple of other people in the bar. I was in shortly before the penalty shootout, and basically, it's all Italian guys are saying, look, the most important thing is that this Italy team has, I guess, done the opposite of what Philippe Auclair was talking about with France yesterday. This Italy team has brought pride back, whether or not they win this penalty shootout, because after the last World Cup and that embarrassing exit under Lippi, there really was a fear that it was going to be a huge road back to ever having a respectable team again. And sort of to an extent, whatever happened in the penalty shootout, well, Prandelli's team had gone out, they'd played attacking football, they'd tried to dictate the match, and they succeeded in doing that. For them to win as well and reach the semi-final, well, that's a whole lot better.
Yeah,
a
semi-final against the Germans. Do you think the impression is now, the feeling will be, well, they can't miss that many chances again? Or is it, oh dear, with strikers that inaccurate, we're really going to struggle against the Teutons?
It's a good question. I think that, you know, it's tricky because obviously your best finisher was on the bench and that's Di Natale. He never got to come on. I think that Abate's injury was obviously a big problem in that regard because it forced Prandelli to use his last substitution on a fullback. But actually, Balotelli, sorry, I think his biggest problem today was that he wanted it too much. Everyone's going to rag on him for missing those chances, but I think it was just one of those matches where he really wanted to show everyone how much he cared about Italy, because he does care an incredible amount about Italy. He always has, always talks about that even when he was a teenager, wanting to represent his country, and perhaps just over anxiety, but he sort of made up for it all in one moment with that sensational penalty. So I don't know, it'll be interesting to see if they go with the same starting lineup, but I think Italy's problem will continue to be finishing off these chances, because while they've got a selection of strong forwards, there's maybe not one guy who's the guy you'll rely on every match to do that for you. Yeah. Also, actually, one other thing just on the Italian commentary, something that would never have happened in England, because it was Rye commentary.
Rye commentary? You wouldn't get that in England, would you?
but after Montolivo missed his penalty, he said, oh, well, usually the team that misses first wins anyway.
Well, I think he might be true. He might be right statistically, is he?
Yeah,
I'm thinking about
statistically
something that would never get said by an English commentator. I don't think you'd have to be pretty brave to say that as any commentator. At the time, I was cursing him, I have to admit.
All right, well, it all turned out all right in the end. The Germans await, Paolo. You have yourself a super time there in atmosphere-less Soho, and we'll speak to you soon.
Speak to you soon, James.
Euro 2012 Football Daily with AC Jimbo.
Well, who was your favourite Italian tonight then, Paul?
I liked Nocerino when he came on.
Yeah, we've been gagging for him to
come
on.
Yeah, yeah. No, I thought, I mean, I've liked the Italians all the way through. I do worry about that, the front line. It's Di Natale, he's the best finisher, but he can't last 90 minutes or...
Well, supposedly, but I think the thing is that they regard Balotelli as a very useful, you know, he's a big man, he's hard to deal with, he causes all sorts of problems at the back, etc. Supposedly he's young and there's going to be great link-up play with Cassano, but Di Natale, I think, there's even a case for making Di Natale play alongside Cassano. People will probably hold their noses at the suggestion, but I don't think Cassano had a good game at all.
No, he didn't.
Nocerino is great because he does give you goals from midfield.
Yeah, the way he took that down, it was great block by Lescott for that chance, but he was right onto that.
Ooh. Do you want to hear my favourite Italian?
Yes.
It's a guy you might have heard of called Andrea Pirlo.
Pirlo!
Brilliant, wasn't he? My favourite, I think, the best
or
moment...
Or Pirlo, as the Pirlo. Italians keep mispronouncing him.
Okay, but the best moment of the match was his penalty. Where 2-1 down, yeah, and he stepped up with a Panenka. The balls to do that. Everyone said that Pirlo was going to get really tired Pirlo. Tonight. That Pirlo was going to... Pirlo was going to... tired tonight, and that didn't really work out. After about an hour, it was suddenly, oh my god, he is completely running the show.
Well, he kind of strolls around, and there was always, it's like he's got really bad breath or something, because nobody's within, I don't know, 5-6 meters of him, and occasionally someone would come along and hurry him, and he would just slowly turn around with the ball glued to his feet and then spray it off somewhere else. But it was, for me, a bit strange how they didn't pay a little bit more attention to him, because lots of other Italian players didn't have anything like the same kind of control of the ball.
Yeah, England seemed happy for much of the game to sit in their two banks of four and let the Italian midfield do whatever they wanted in front of them. But most of the Italian chances came from balls that went over the top of the defence. That was too easy for them.
Mm. Well, two questions to finish this bit off then. One, what about John Terry? Has he played his last game in an England shirt?
Hopefully.
He did have a good game tonight.
Jacob, he had a great game.
He had a great game in many ways.
Yeah.
Italy's profligacy is what made England's defenders look good. If Italy had taken their chances and England had lost 4-0, then no one would be saying, well, Terry and Lescott, they were great.
Yeah.
Was that bit in the Ukraine game where they said, oh, you've got to give John Terry credit for clearing off the line? But no, it was a goal. He didn't clear it off the line. He got there too late, and because he was too slow, it went in.
Paul?
I think that they didn't concede for a reason, and that's because they did defend very well. But I do think it's, you know,
Italy could have scored four or five tonight.
They had half chances that maybe if they'd created a proper chance out of it, it might have been.
They did hit the post
goal,
as well.
That was a goal.
Dave Rossi's was a proper chance, the one that he scuffed wide.
Yeah, he scuffed that one wide. And then that was the best chance.
Montolivo for open goal over the bar.
All right, here's the other question then. What chance do Italy have on that performance against the Germans? Well, how do you see that semi-final shaping up?
Decent chance, but Germany's strong favourites.
Germany look amazing.
Yeah. Do you not think that Germany will play at a pace that will completely confound just the way that the Italians play tonight anyway?
They're strong all the way through the team, the Germans.
And so dynamic. And I just don't think that Italy, impressive as they looked for much of today against a really poor opposition, I'm not sure that they're ready to compete against that the level of dynamism and movement that you get from Germany. They entered this game, Italy, with suspect central defence, which was never tested, and they will not have such an easy night on Thursday. And midfielders who strolled around the pitch choosing when they wanted to play the ball and to whom. And it won't happen.
Well, it was the semi-final that they wanted, according to Raphael Honigstein. They got this big thing about the Italians, of course, 2006 World Cup, 1970 World Cup, the game of the century. Always classics. Always classics. So we're looking forward to that on Thursday. Meantime, Mr. Roy returns back to England. And, you know, given the circumstances, fair enough.
Yeah, I don't think today was his best game. Unfortunately, I thought the substitutions were wrong. I thought the double substitution in particular, I thought. The tactic of playing it long so often, I just bamboozled by that.
What I don't get about tonight, there was a point in the first half where England won the ball in the left corner of their defence, and with a sequence of one-touch passes, retaining possession all the time, broke down England's right wing. And I felt like leaping out of my chair and punching the air and shouting Eureka. If they can do that, why don't they do it?
I'm just going to step out the bar.
No, don't. I love that bar ambiance. Usually we have to pay Ben to play in bits of bar ambiance just to give the show a lift. You've got real bar ambiance right there.
It's kind of bizarre East European Europe pop.
So. Oh, that's what we want. That's what we want. Is it a gay bar?
I don't think so.
All right.
It's the bar of my hotel. It's just the bar of my hotel. So
maybe it's a gay hotel, Sid. Nobody's judging.
That's the important thing.
Right. Anyway, where is your hotel, Sid?
It's in Donetsk.
All right, then. Cool.
Where, of course, Spain played last night.
That's
and we'll
right.
play in, three nights' time. I've been a lucky boy, James.
Go on.
I get to stay here for a week rather than dashing around backwards and forwards.
What does a young buck like yourself do on the mean streets of Donetsk when there's not a game in town?
Well, this is the thing. Donetsk actually, from what I can make out so far, doesn't have very much, or pretty much doesn't have anything. It's a city with not much going on. But I mean, actually, I wouldn't have had the chance to see anything anyway because Donetsk is 2 hours ahead of the UK. So by the time I'd got back from the game last night, it was already nearly 3 o'clock in the morning. The first night I was working on previews. So even if this was the greatest city on earth, even if this was Donetsk, the city that never sleeps, I probably still wouldn't have seen it.
But Sid, you live in Madrid, where they don't have lunch till 3 a.m.
They actually, tragically in Madrid, they did close down the restaurant that I'd like to go to and eat steak at 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah.
Oh,
finest restaurant of all time.
Like
which was actually next door to a gay club, to follow on from the conversation from earlier on, and they owned the gay club next door, and they had a door into the gay club so that you didn't have to go out and queue up and come back in again.
All right, then. But they paved paradise and they put up a parking lot, didn't they, Sid? Anyway, listen, let's head back to the game last night, the Spain game, of course, against France. Now, Sid, loads of people have been posting in on both sides of the Spain debate, yeah? Some people have been saying, oh dear, they're a bit dull, aren't they? And I must admit, we were doing a bit of that in the pod ourselves yesterday. And other people have been saying, I'm thoroughly disgusted. This is the Thought Fox here with this backlash against the best international team we've seen. I thought football was above this movement, which is more recognisable in music. A band is cool until it becomes popular, etc., etc., etc. So what's the reaction been like in Spain? Are the Spanish themselves, are they happy with the way things are going?
Well, the first thing to say is that I'm not in Spain, but the reaction amongst the Spaniards here, and of course most of them being the journalists, that obviously they're therefore are the ones that to some extent are leading the, if you like, the opinion, at least in the media back in Spain. And there was a sense last night that Spain were not particularly sparkling, that it wasn't particularly brilliant, but that there was, I think there was a sense of satisfaction, I would say, rather than joy in the degree of control that Spain exercised. That even, you listen, for example, listen to Xavi Hernandez talk last night, as I did, and he was saying, look, we weren't that brilliant. We struggled because of the heat. And actually, I think there's an important question there. Spain are based in Poland. They flew back to Poland. Poland is like a British winter. Ukraine's not far off a Spanish summer, you know, in terms of the difference in temperatures. And Xavi Hernandez said that they really struggled in the second half. He said, we dropped off and we played 10 or 15 metres deeper than we normally would. We closed the game off and we controlled it, but it wasn't particularly sparkling. And I think that has led to a response that generally I would describe as satisfaction with what Spain did, rather than joy, but also a sense that, of looking at Spain and saying, wow, we're really well placed because we do look really, really strong and no one is causing us problems. Although, of course, that's a bit short-sighted because just the game before, Croatia did have chances to have beaten them.
Right. Well, it's not like the Spanish to be caught out in the heat, one imagines. It's just a feeling, I think, generally, that it's just not that exciting watching Spain because, of course, they're very, very, very good. Monktonian says, he puts it like this, if it was somehow possible, what match would people prefer to see? Spain versus Spain or Germany versus Germany? With my answer would be Holland versus Holland. That would be absolutely full on. I'd love to see that. But I think...
Holland versus Holland happens at every tournament.
France. Yeah. But I think that's the point, that there's a little bit more throws and spills with the Germans. But hey, there'll be time for that.
Can I answer that for you? Or
yeah.
Can I try and answer that for you to some extent? Which is that we say it's a little bit boring watching Spain. I think that phrase needs to be rephrased, which is it's a little bit boring watching Spain play against whoever it is they're playing against.
Yeah.
Now, Spain's boringness is, of course, and by the way, I don't share the idea that Spain are boring, but I understand that people do. That people do believe that. Spain's boringness, I think, is, A, of course, partly a product of the fact that they control games. And to some extent, what we want as neutrals is to see a fantastically open match with both teams really going for each other. It swings backwards and forwards, and of course what makes for exciting and open games is mistakes that Spain don't make, the lack of control, which Spain do have control all the time, so you don't get that. The other thing in this is why I say it's not about watching Spain, it's about watching Spain and their opponents. One of the reasons why Spain's games are not quite so exciting is because we're seeing something absolutely unique. I think for the first time, certainly that I can remember, we see a national team that is better than everybody else. And every team they play adapts their game to play Spain. Every team, even the French, who've been playing well, and Laurent Blanc had a go at England for being defensive and boring, comes up to Spain and he thinks, tell you what, two right backs on the pitch. Super, super defensive. And of course you say, well, in a way we're almost having a go at Spain for A, being too good, therefore there's no competition. It's a bit like having a go at Sampras or winning Wimbledon 6 years in a row. Oh, it's boring because he always wins. Well, that's not his fault that he's better than everyone else. Or more to the point, it's not his fault.
Sid, you're doing a Spain on us. Sid, no, you're doing a Spain on us. You'd completely controlled that conversation and shut it down. Amazing job.
Well, I did.
But I want to pick you up on one that you said they're better than everybody. Are they better than Germany?
That's a good question. Now, this is the point. And I do think that it's going to be really interesting to see them if they do both get to the final, which is by no means guaranteed. It's going to be really interesting to see them against Germany because I think Germany might be close to as good as Spain. It's very, very difficult to know that. But of course, Spain are absolutely clear in the way they play and their identity, and the fact that they play a game that's all about control means that maybe they will be able to close Germany down as well. And maybe it won't be hugely exciting, and maybe then we will be able to point the finger and say it's partly Spain's fault. But there's another factor in all this. We laud teams that are defensively strong. A heroic Chelsea win the Champions League, for example. And yet now we're slagging off Spain, who are doing exactly the same thing, just in a different manner. It's the same pragmatic thing. Their aim is to win the games, not to entertain us. Admittedly, where it does become frustrating to people, I think, is that sometimes that sense of it being almost morally superior. But now we're having such a backlash that even that doesn't stand up anymore. I don't know if they're better than Germany. I think that's going to be a really, really, really interesting test.
All right. And the Portugal game, Sid?
Well, the Portugal game's an interesting one. In theory, at least, Portugal are set up to play on the break and cause problems because Cristiano Ronaldo and Nani have the pace, I think, to threaten the two fullback positions for Spain, which theoretically are weak, although Jordi Alba's had a really good tournament. But theoretically, you can push behind them, and you do have that outlet ball to Ronaldo. And again, Spain's way of stopping Ronaldo being good will be to control the ball and not allow Portugal to have it often enough to be able to launch those counter-attacks. And by the way, Spain are not as vulnerable to those kind of counter-attacks as Barcelona. They are more conservative than Barcelona. They are more about control than Barcelona are. It's also worth pointing something out. I think some of these teams are getting it wrong. The assumption that against Spain you park the bus and you wait. Well, the evidence suggests this doesn't work. So if we're going to talk about it pragmatically, it feels like it's working because you only lose 1-0 and say, oh, we're always in the game. But the bottom line is Spain on winning.
Well, you're right, of course. You know what, Sid, you're absolutely right when you say a lot of it is the other team's fault, and no question about that. And there's no question as well that we're all getting a bit blasé, I guess, about the displays of footballing excellence to which they are treating us, and I suspect they're going to treat us to another one.
See, that's the thing. I mean, I understand it's entirely... I mean, and actually, the interview I did with Álvaro Arbeloa, one of the questions I put to him was that people in England say you're boring, say that Spain are boring. And he said, to be honest with you, I can understand that. I can understand that in a culture where they really like a very open game, where they really like lots of end-to-end action, that a team like us that is defined by control, and I think this is the thing we've sometimes missed over the last few years, we like to think that we define Spain by creativity. No, they're defined by control. And Arbeloa said, I can understand why people don't always find that very exciting.
Mm. Well, there you go. Anyway, Portugal, that's up next, and they may well have all the opportunities to be creative and full of flair and risk-taking, etc. In that, Sid, enjoy yourself.
They won't take risks, James. They won't. I mean, this is true. They won't take risks.
Do you not think that in 2008 they did take risks? They took more risks in the game.
Right, I think 2008... No, I'm not really sure they took more risks. I think 2008 is a different case, and it's quite a useful way of judging what Spain are now is to compare them with 2008. I think there's a couple of differences. In 2008, they got through the group stage where they were still trying to get their ideas clear, and you look at the group stage and they scored 6 goals in the group stage, 5 of them on the counter-attack, and one of them was, I think, a set play. So it wasn't this kind of pure controlling tiki-taka that we talk about now. It is true they were a bit more expansive in the sense they only had one defensive midfielder with Luis Aragonés as coach, that was Marcos Senna, and now they have two, which is Xavi Alonso and Sergio Busquets. But in the group stage, it was breaking away from teams that made them find a way through. They then get to Russia, and they completely tiki-tackered Russia to death, and that really was... they get Italy first, 0-0, and they go through on penalties. So you say, and they were a little bit fortunate. Then they get Russia, and they completely destroy them, and in the final, they win 1-0. So in a way, that's not massively different from what happened in 2010 and what's happening now as Spain started to find their feet. The other big, big difference is that in 2008, the opposition had not yet assimilated the fact or the assumption or the sense that Spain were the best team in the world, and therefore the opposition had to adapt to Spain all the time. Now they believe that. For right or wrong, every team adapts to Spain and every team turns defensive against them.
Sid, what did Negredo do to Del Bosque's daughter?
I don't know. What did Negredo
I don't know. Why? No, I mean, this is the other question that people ask. Why? Why are those people there? Llorente, why can't he get even a minute on the field? Why are these players... Why is there no use of the centre-forwards that he's taken, apart from Torres?
One of the things that I must say I think is absolutely bizarre and absurd and deeply unfair that I've read quite a lot is that Spain play without a number 9 because they're so arrogant. That's absolute bollocks. Right? Spain play without a number 9... Because for precisely the opposite reason, because they're fearful, because they want to control the game, because they want to try and do something different, and because the other team is extremely defensive and plays very deep. And I think Del Bosque is looking at it and thinking, if they play very deep, our number 9 is possibly going to have nowhere to manoeuvre. Fernando Torres in particular, who needs space behind a defence, is not that much use to you if the other team plays really, really deep, because there's nowhere for him to run into. And the same is broadly true, not quite as much, but broadly true of Álvaro Negredo. So why do they play with a false number 9? So that they have that mobility, so that they try and pull the defence out, and so that the attacker is arriving in the area at a time when the defence can't deal with it from a little bit deeper, as indeed Cesc Fabregas in that first goal. So it's not about arrogance. That said, I will say that I think that I'm surprised that Llorente hasn't played more, because he is a solution when the other team is ridiculously deep, because he can stop them playing quite so deep, because if you play deep to someone who's that good in the air, you do struggle, and defences may be forced out a little bit. The question mark with Llorente, I think, is his physical fitness, and he finished the season absolutely shattered, and I think that has played on Del Bosque's mind a little bit. But the false number nine thing is absolutely not an expression of arrogance. There are many, many things you can say about Vicente Del Bosque, but he certainly isn't an arrogant man.
Hey, well, that's cleared that up, everyone. Spain not arrogant, nor boring particularly. Little bit OCD about their football, but hey, you know, we've all got our hang-ups. You feel better about that, Jacob?
No, not really.
Oh,
no.
Come on.
No, but I won't have a go at them tonight. We got it out of the way last night, I think.
I think they're going to tear it up against Portugal.
Tear it up.
My theory is that Portugal, for one night, they have a moral obligation to let Jose manage them. Paulo Bento should step aside, and then he can come in, and they'll
poke
just
people in the
line, 10 people across the 6-yard line, all of them flicking V's at the Spanish. Any guy who comes near them, Pepe just boots him away. And then Ronaldo, like 60 yards away from the rest of them, just shooting every time he gets it.
I'd pay to watch that.
Somebody on the blog accused me of being neo-liberal because I wanted Ronaldo to win.
And then I think he's got a perfect right to say that.
No, me too. I think it was a very astute point. But he went on to say that Ronaldo was named Ronaldo because his dad was a big fan of Ronald Reagan. Is that true?
Yeah.
That is amazing. I did not know that.
I got called left wing tonight for apparently wanting England to lose in the minute by minute.
Yeah, it's quite left
wing.
Yeah.
I don't know if politics come into...
No, it's funny, you know, if you could give, if that was one of the options when you post messages with a little white feather thing, I'm sure we'd have been handed plenty over various England performances. There's something apparently deeply unpatriotic about the way we responded to England's uninspiring showing. But there you go. So be it.
But even then you put in the words uninspiring. What about that turnaround against the Swedes? It was
What about that?
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. Anyway, well, happy days. Off they go. And four teams remain: Spain and Portugal and Italy and Germany. Proper footballing sides for a proper Euro 2012 set of semi-finals. We'll be back after Monday, although on Monday, actually, there'll be a little paper review of what the Euro press made of it all so far. Do join us for that and the next time we're up with the pod. Not sure when that'll be. Meantime, Simon, thanks so much for sticking around to be with us this evening, and you, Jacob Steinberg, and you, Paul McInnes, and you, producer Ben, and you, random Ukrainian man with helpful directions to the donut shop. We'll speak to you soon. Bye for now.
Euro 2012 Football Daily. Woof.